Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's show, we are going to talk about alternative ways of funding your business for growth, for reorganization, and just what are they? On the program today, we have a great guest for you. His name is Jeff Wolf. He's with the Forest Firm, and Jeff joined the Forest Firm this year, but he began his career with the law firm of Smith, Anderson, Blount, Dorset, Mitchell, and Jernigan in Raleigh, where he served the firm's corporate clients for nearly 6 years. His areas of practice include corporate formation and governance, commercial contracts, and strategic transactions. His transactional background includes extensive experience in mergers and acquisitions, equity offerings, and debt financings. Now, Jeff has advised companies at every size and stage of the business life cycle, from small startups to large public companies. He has his law degree from Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, and he was there as the executive editor also of the Wake Forest Law Review. He graduated in 2005 with a Phi Beta Kappa honors from the Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, where he got a bachelor's degree in political science and economics. Jeff is also an active community member as a volunteer with Special Olympics. And so we are really honored to have Jeff in the studio today and to acknowledge that the Forest Firm is one of our underwriters for the show on WCOM-FM. Now, the firm's founder, James Forrest, has been a guest on our show before, and you probably recall, but let me refresh your mind, that the Forest Firm is a full-service legal counsel firm providing customized services to meet client needs and exceed client expectations. They like to demystify the legal billings and legal lingo, and enable their clients to have predictable legal expenses and protect their businesses by not being afraid to give a call to the attorney, and they won't be surprised by the cost. Now, the Forest Firm has a different business model and is one of the most innovative law firms I think I've ever dealt with. So, Jeff, I want to thank you for being on the show today, and let's kind of get a feel for where we want to start. What are we talking about today with funding? What are our options? How do they impact the business? And just get us started.
Okay, great. Well, first, I just want to thank you for having me here today. I'm very excited to be here, excited to be at the Forest Firm now, and we're happy to be a sponsor. And just, yeah, as a small business, you know, we run through a lot of the same legal issues that, you know, the business owners throughout this area run into. And so we're happy to, you know, support this small business and this radio station, and just assist people, and that's our job. So what I want to talk about today is as you mentioned, James Forrest came on before and talked about forming a company and different options for different entities. And the second question we usually get is, okay, I formed a company, now how do I raise money? So there's a variety of ways to do this, and so we can talk about different avenues, but I, you know, think we'll focus on kind of a general, either a startup business or a small business it could be in the retail industry, just somebody that started a business and wants to raise money to grow that business.
So we're going to talk about, it's a small business. It's the mom and pop. It's the corner grocery store. It's the small accounting firm. It's the tech company spinning out of the university. It's all of those that we want to talk about today and what the options are then.
Yes. And, you know, the first thing you'll hear is, you know, the recommendation that you don't want to raise too much money and you don't want to focus on, you know, getting money from investors as your goal. I mean, the goal for business is you want to, you know,
to grow.
Yeah, to execute that business.
To be in business, to generate the cash flow, to be in business and not necessarily need it.
Right.
So but be able to get it if you need it.
Right. So the first question is, you know, how much, you know, do you need money? And then if you do need money, how much do you need? And so.
And I'll add one thing to that. What do you need it for?
Right. And that's going to be important to the investors as well. So the question of do you need money, it's can you survive without that money? And I mean, our general recommendation is try to bootstrap, try to do whatever you can. Now, don't run up your credit card bills and get into trouble where you can't get out of. But it's very difficult to kind of from day one just go out and say, I want to raise $1 million. It's going to be hard to find investors.
Right, especially in this environment that we're in where investors have more opportunities than there's investor money out there. And they're being later in the stage. They want more assurance. They want more confidence in what you're doing. So if you're opening the door day one and you're trying to raise $1 million, that's more difficult because you don't have a track record, right? You don't have the customer. You don't have the demonstration of your product, whatever. And so what you're advising is wait as long as you can, get as good position as you can, doing what you can, bootstrapping, stretching that money that you do have. And yes, a lot of my clients use those credit cards. But doing it in a wise way. And then we know we need money. We know what we're going to need it for. And then what do we do?
Right. And yeah, that's a good point as far as, you know, the supply is low out there, but also the demand is picking up as more entrepreneurs are venturing out there and starting things. Fortunately, a lot of businesses are able to bootstrap. And, you know, if you're making an app, you don't really need a large office and kind of the traditional startup capital. So once you've decided to raise capital, then the question is, you know, kind of how are you going to structure that and who are you going to go after?
So what do you mean by how are we going to structure it?
So the first thing would be what are you selling and who are you selling to?
So what are we offering? Is it equity? Is it debt? Is it convertible? And we'll explain some of that later. Right.
And yeah, for what we're kind of talking about today, I would say would be traditional, you know, you're selling some type of security. And so a security is defined in the securities laws very broadly. And that picks up what you would normally think of as a public company stock. It'll include private company stocks of common stock and preferred stock, but it also includes, you know, debt. If you're selling notes to a bunch of investors, that's going to be deemed a security. So
one quick question. When we say stock, we sell that in a corporation, but what do we call it when it's an LLC?
It's a membership interest, and North Carolina actually recently revised their statutes, and sometimes it's now referred to as economic interest or an LLC interest. You'll kind of hear different things, but it's the same ownership principle.
It's the same concept. It's just called something differently and executed a bit differently.
Correct.
Okay.
And sometimes that's going to be more difficult to sell being in an LLC simply because the tax consequences would be different from a member, where if somebody comes from the outside, they might not want, you know, tax or pass through taxation. So, you know, we can jump into that later, but yeah, so I'll generally be referring to stock and
okay, so we're going to, for this conversation today, we're primarily talking about C corporations or S corporations and raising funds for those, because that's somewhat the simplest way to look at this.
Yes.
There's nothing simple.
And in particular with C corps, because S corps also brings into that same issue of an investor may not want to be taxed as an S corp because they won't meet the definition if they're, you know, entity of foreign individual, or they don't want that pass through taxation.
So the C corporations that we talk about, typically, if we want to raise money, that's the preferred legal structure, tax structure that most investors want to look at. And there are some preferences of where we're incorporated. We've talked about with James previously and with other guests that there is some preference if you're a North Carolina corporation or a Delaware corporation, and those kind of things have an impact.
Correct. And you'll see the most common is Delaware, simply because they have a long history of, you know, kind of business friendly practices, but also a very business focused court, and have just, you know, kind of been the pioneers in corporate law. And so
it gives everyone a more of a certainty. So if you got to court, you kind of have a feel as to what the judgment will be or what the rules are and the interpretations of things.
Right. And then, you know, the second common would be wherever the state or wherever the business is located. So our client base, you know, I'd say 50-50 are Delaware or North Carolina, because there's some conveniences of being in North Carolina, and most states have, in particular North Carolina, have, you know, adopted Delaware law for kind of major issues. And so there's not as many differences with North Carolina as there would be, let's say, California or New York and some different states.
I always say California is a whole different country. So we're looking to raise, let's say we're a small business. We want to start another location. Say we're based here in Raleigh. We decide we need to open an office in Charlotte. Let's say it's going to take $500,000. We know how much. We know what we're going to use it for. So what's that process? We decide what kind of equity, what kind of security, what is it?
First, I would say you want to figure out who you're going to sell to, because a lot of times that will drive the investment vehicle, meaning, you know, your friends and family, they might be willing to purchase common stock in your company, whereas, you know, venture capitalists might not be willing to buy common stock. They'll want preferred stock with more features. Right. And so let's
talk about, again, refresh everybody. Common stock means what?
So that's the most common, you know, ownership level of, it's just the general.
So right. Everybody, we own it. Mm-hmm. If there's no preferred stock after, this is the simplest way usually for me to deal with it with customers, is that if you filed bankruptcy, at the end of it, the common stockholder is the last person to collect whatever's left over.
Right. And they share pro rata and, you know, to get their whatever's left.
Right. Preferred stock would mean there's a preference over and above the common stock, and they have different rights that can be added.
Yes. And those rights can be voting rights. Those rights can be, you know, dividend rights.
Cumulative dividend rights, all kinds of things.
Correct. You can describe common stock in about two sentences, and a lot of times it'll take 20 pages to describe preferred stock.
Right.
So it can get complicated.
And that's why a lot of the venture capitalists or angel investors, or even your more sophisticated seed round friends and family, may have preferred stock as their preference. That's why it's called preferred stock, because it gives them something to queue up ahead of everyone else.
That's correct. And if you start with preferred stock, there isn't the common stock that's being left, you know, holding nothing. So it's perfectly fine to have, you know, a small amount of common stock, or founders have common stock, but then use the preferred stock as your vehicle. Now, what you'll then see is that a lot of times it'll be different series of preferred stock. So the first people that come in will buy Series A preferred stock, and then if the company down the road needs more money, you'll jump in and buy Series B preferred stock.
And is that just the fact that we're offering different groupings of it, or does it mean that it has different characteristics when we do Series A, Series B, Series C?
It generally will mean different characterizations, or, you know, characteristics of, a lot of times it's going to be conversion price will be different. They might ask for different features, but it's also to protect a lot of times the Series A, who have already pre-negotiated certain rights, that if somebody down the road comes in, that, you know, they're still going to be treated first and have the liquidation preference you were referring to of getting their money first. So, you know, you always kind of want to be in there. The earlier, the better. Now, obviously, it's riskier the earlier you're in.
Right, but that's why they ask for a bit more. If you come in early, the risk preference, there's things you want for having taken that risk.
Right.
And that's why they want preference, they want liquidation or anti-dilution, all of those kind of options in there. So when we're out, we're raising funds, we've talked about friends and family. I know there have been legislative changes to some of the definition stuff. Do friends and family have to be accredited investors, meaning high net worth individuals making a certain level of income, or can they be unaccredited or non-accredited investors?
Good question. They do not have to be accredited investors, but the main thing when we're talking about, you know, selling a security, which what we're talking about is common stock or preferred stock or debt securities, is to make sure you're complying with the securities laws. And as I said, the definition of securities is defined broadly, but then the offer and sale of securities is also defined broadly. And if you're going to offer or sell securities, you know, our federal statute requires that you either register those securities with the Securities and Exchange Commission, or you meet an exemption under that the Securities Act and the rules promulgated thereunder. And so there's kind of a lot of safe harbors you can fall into when you're selling stock, but, you know, you want to consult with an attorney mostly to figure out which exemption you're going to go after. And so just to kind of back up, you know, the public offering, what we're talking about, is a very expensive process and is not going to be on the minds of a new business or a small business.
Well, that's when we're talking about IPOs, when Facebook or some, you know, some of the big names we've seen, Google did those private placements. Those public offerings are not private placements. I mean, it goes out to the public. There's an initial public offering out there, and everybody lines up. And if your Facebook goes crazy to purchase that, right?
Correct. Yeah, you and I can go out and buy Facebook stock. We can buy public company stock, but we can't just walk into a small business and buy their stock without kind of making sure that sale complies with the securities laws, and obviously they have the choice to turn that down, and it's a heavily negotiated process. So correct. So there's the public offering side, which is what you normally see of when you're watching the news and they're talking about stock prices and everything.
The New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, all of those types of things.
Right. And now those companies can raise money privately as well. So, you know, they have that option. But so for our purposes, we'll just be discussing private offerings. However, that doesn't mean you're immune to the
rules and regulations.
Correct.
Right.
And so
as we all know, when there's rules and regulations from the government, there's very rarely complete immunity, even if you have exemptions and special circumstances.
Right. And the Securities Act is from 1933 and, you know, was kind of in response to the Great Depression and making sure, you know, investors were informed and were, you know, somebody was regulating what was going on. And so, as you mentioned, I mean, they're still changing today to try to kind of perfect the system, and a lot of times it's through finding flaws. A lot of times, you know, recently it's with the Jobs Act, and that was
right, a technology change, sort of a roll it back and say, okay, go crowdfund, go make what used to be prohibited offerings. Now we were talking on one of the previous shows that you could come on the radio and now pretty much talk about that you're raising funds and what it's like and all those kind of things and not be in violation.
Right. And there's always the hoops to jump through, but they have been, you know, broadening that to allow, you know, investor or companies to raise money while still trying to protect investors. So it's always kind of that balancing act of, you know, the way the state laws are defined is, you know, they're called blue sky laws, and that was because they wanted to prevent somebody selling a piece of the blue sky. And so
or the Brooklyn Bridge.
Right. So you want to be able to protect investors that they don't, you know, go to a website and put their credit card in and they're left, you know, with nothing. So generally, when we're kind of talking about the securities law exemptions, there are different requirements as far as, you know, how many investors can participate, how much money you can raise, and then what you need to supply those investors. And so for friends and family, if they're not accredited, you can probably do a small offering and meet one of the exemptions and not have to
go through all of the filings, the formal documents, the formal due diligence process, all of those kind of things.
Right. It's more limited disclosure of what you have to disclose to them. And as you kind of increase the offering in size and to people, you need to provide more information.
Right.
You need to provide financial statements. And so that's for investor protection and, you know, allows both parties to kind of negotiate that based on the
right.
rules.
So it's and even when we're providing that information, there's rules as to how we're presenting it, you know, GAAP presented statements, things of that nature, so that they're comparable and people can look at them and it's not just accounting any way you wanted to report it. So we're still looking at those kind of metrics and standards for us presenting the information as we get less and less related people or people who know us involved.
That's correct. And that brings up a good point that, you know, that requires a level of sophistication. So for a small business that has just been keeping track of their financials on a spreadsheet or and you're not having annual audited financial statements, that can be kind of one of the first points to prepare for is, you know, we have to get the financial statements in place.
You have to get ready because when you're going to raise, it's not simply going out and saying, okay, this is what I have and this is a great idea. We have to say why it's a great idea, how we're going to get a return on that investment, what our past history is, how it's going to affect that. And again, I call it housekeeping. Before you open your books to everyone, those books have to be what they should be. Usually we say for the past 3 years. So if you've been in business 10 years, we at least have to go back and look at the last 3 years, make sure all the taxes are current, you're doing everything you're supposed to and everything's in order so that when that investor comes in and looks in that due diligence process, you don't get caught up or lose an investor because something wasn't taken care of in that groundwork for the business.
Yeah, that's a good point. You want to have your everything lined up and your ducks in a row so when people come in, you know, you don't want to lose them. And
yeah, you usually get one chance to make a great impression, especially when you're presenting your financial information in your business.
Right. And even to get in the door, you're going to need to have, you know, certain things to be able to provide to them. And it just shows, you know, the more sophisticated it can be, the more, you know, polished it can be. It shows the investors, you know, if they're receiving hundreds of these kind of requests, that you've done your homework and are ready. And yeah, they won't come back a second time if they felt they wasted their time the first time.
So like our friends and family may be sophisticated, maybe high net worth, may not. Angel investors then tends to be where we next go, right? People we may have met somewhere or through one of the angel groups or a CED or some organization. And they tend to be more sophisticated and expect a minimum standard for a package or a presentation coming to them, right?
That's right. And they can be a great asset. You know, what I always tell people too is you want their money, but you also want their advice. Usually, you know, they have a history of investing in companies and can kind of guide you and can be a good mentoring partner. And you want to make sure that relationship's good, because depending on the stake you sell to them, they're going to have some control. And so you always want to be careful, even with friends and family, that you're not bringing in investors that are going to be trouble down the
road.
They're
going to complicate your life.
Right. And yeah, and by trouble and complication, I don't mean, you know, they're you know, going out in public and saying bad things, but it can be as simple as they're hard to get a hold of and you can't get their consent for them to sign a document or things along those lines.
Right. Or I know I've run into this with several clients in the past that they probably didn't do sufficient due diligence on the people they accepted funds from. And it became a complication later when they found somebody had, you know, fraud or felony fraud charges and had been in jail for that. And here's someone that's on their board now because as an investor, he came in, and that kind of venture capitalists were no longer willing to invest when they saw this person had such a significant role in the company as an investor. And that was just a turnoff. So we have to do our due diligence, too, on who we're talking, how, you know, other companies they've invested in, talk to those other CEOs that they've worked with. All of those kind of things make an interesting dynamic because it's like a marriage. Once they've bought in, until you can either buy them out or they sell the stock or something, they're there.
Right.
You're going to have to deal with them.
And knowing their history can be very helpful, too, from the standpoint of you may have a different idea of what your exit event looks like as far as either process or timing. And so to know, okay, they typically come in and want to sell within 5 years might be different than your plans to have it be a, you know, lifetime company, and then sell when you want to, you know, pass it to the next generation.
That kind of is an interesting thing with the dynamics of the company that you're in. Is it a growth company that you're going to, you know, you're going to come in, you're going to take investors, and then you want it to be bought out, you want to be merged? Do you want to run it as more of a lifestyle, a life commitment, that type of thing? And that's something when we're taking on investors that we really have to think about and make sure that personality and that goal matches up.
Right. And especially once you start talking about going over the 50% threshold of kind of giving control, you know, I've seen it where you sell control thinking, oh, we're bringing a lot of money in, but then the next day you're fired.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's great you raised all that money, but you no longer have a job. And so, you know, if you're selling minority investments, they're still going to have certain rights, but you know, you kind of always want to make sure you maintain the ability to run the business that you want, the way you want to run
it. And I always tell people, when money's involved, alliances can change when you come to a difference in opinion how something, the direction the company should go, or how a technology should be used, or how you're going to commercialize something, or how you're going to grow.
Right. And that kind of, in my head, just makes me think of the family and friends round. What's great if you can get money from them, but yeah, it's difficult when those conversations are occurring at Thanksgiving on, you know, why aren't you pursuing this strategy or doing that?
One, I know I've worked with small businesses, family owned businesses, where the parents started it and say there's five kids to inherit it and they're all involved in the company. That family dynamic comes in, and when they start raising funds, you start seeing that dynamic want to hold. So the baby of the company, in this instance I'm thinking of, he was the most sophisticated, most qualified, most business savvy of all of the family members, but no one listened to him because he was the baby of the family, right? I don't think it could have mattered if he had his law degree, an MBA from Harvard, whatever. He could have any credentials, but all the family could see was he's the baby of the family.
Right.
And here's the, you know, the potential investor saying, well, I'm only investing if he's in charge. And the family's go, oh, but he's the baby of the family. And that dynamic holds things up.
Yeah, that's right. And that just brings up to the point of investors can have a lot of control even before it happens of, okay, if I'm going to invest, you know, this is who I want on the management team.
Right.
And really kind of guide the process that way. And so, yeah, it's important to know who your investors are. But even if you have a great relationship, you just have to expect that they're going to demand things in exchange.
To protect their interest.
Correct.
Well, and that's where we get into the venture capitalists, and that's probably the one of the most sophisticated investment groups that tend to come in. They have a return on investment they want to hit. They have expectations. They have all that timing that you're talking about. And they tend to want to control some board seats, control some of the executive positions, say the CEO, the COO, or the CFO, something in there that gives them someone that they know has a track record. Mm-hmm. And those strings come in with that investment.
Yes. And so venture capitalists are usually the most sought after, but then they can also be the kind of strictest from the standpoint of they'll have their internal policies of, you know, we invest X amount and it, on these terms. And
right.
So you have to live with that. But that's also very sought after.
And like, I'd say the golden rule, those that have the gold write the rules.
That's right.
So when it comes to investing, you have less of a tendency, unless you have a lot of choices of who you can take money from, and you may be blessed to have an idea that's something like that. But otherwise, when you're out there and you're trying to raise $300,000 or $500,000, and that person wants to write the check, those term sheets, and we need to talk about what a term sheet is, they get to dictate more of those terms than you do.
Right. And your options start to run out. So, you know, you're going to run out of family and friends that can raise above $1 million. You're going to run out of angel investors who are willing to give above $1 million. So you're going to have to deal with venture capitalists. And it's a good thing. And,
right.
And for the same thing I was talking about, angel investors, they can provide, you know, networks and they can provide mentorships. And really, they provide, you know, some legitimacy to your company.
Well, they a lot of times come in, and that's the point that the organizations really have to become a, I'm going to say, real business in quotes, in that there's policies, there's processes, there's expectations of how things will be done, and they will be documented, and your financial statements will be a certain way, and the board will run a certain way. They force you to do the things every good business does.
Right, and that's why when we were kind of talking about before of making sure you need the money is important, because before you agree to things, it sounds great to say we raised $5 million, but if it creates a headache down the road and you can survive on $1 million from friends and family and angel investors, go that route.
Right, so we've talked about private offerings, we've talked about public offerings, we've talked about who we may want to have invest. When we come back from the break, I kind of want to talk about what are those different categories and rounds of raising capital. We've alluded to those with round C, Series A, Series B. And we're going to get into the timing and all the things that we need to do. So when we come back from the break, we're going to continue the conversation with Jeff Wolf of The Forest Firm.
And get to know Focus Resources, your strategic, operational, and financial business consultant. Visit their website at www.focusresourcesinc.com. That's www.focusresourcesinc.com. We'd also like to thank Harrington Bank, your community bank. Get to know your neighbor at www.bankatharrington.com. That's www.bankatharrington.com. And finally, we'd like to thank IWP Photography, capturing the important moments of your professional, business, and personal life. With event photography and live event painting, get to know them at their website, www.iwpphotography.com. That's www.iwpphotography.com. Thanks to all of our underwriters. Focus on Business and WCOM FM are proud to support the Ronald McDonald House of Durham. To learn more about the Ronald McDonald House of Durham, visit their website at www.ronaldhousedurham.org. That's www.ronaldhousedurham.org. Or give them a call at 919-281-1065. WCOM-FM and Focus on Business are proud to support Make-A-Wish of Eastern North Carolina, serving the Triangle. Make-A-Wish of Eastern North Carolina is your community Make-A-Wish. To learn more about what Make-A-Wish is doing, Visit their website at www.eastnc.wish.org. That's www.eastnc.wish.org. Or give them a call at 1-800-432-WISH. That's 1-800-432-9474.
Welcome back to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. Before the break, I was talking with my guest, Jeff Wolf of The Forrest Firm. That's forrestfirm.com, F-O-R-R-E-S-T-F-I-R-M.com, about the options for funding a growing business. Jeff, let's dig into the different rounds of investment that we can go through. What are they? How do we decide what's appropriate round for us and those kind of things?
Sure, I think that makes sense. And you know, a lot of this is just vocabulary of knowing when somebody says they're doing a seed round or a Series A round, of just knowing where that, what that means. But usually these rounds kind of follow what we were talking about of the friends and family, angel investors, and venture capital. So the first round is the micro and seed capital. That's typically where an entrepreneur has a business plan but may not have sufficient funds to finance the capital requirements. And so that's usually friends and family and going to angel investors.
And so when we're talking about a business plan in that case, we're talking about the basic financial statements of how you've been doing business, a forecast of what we're going to look like after we get the money, and then the who, the what, the how of the business, right?
Correct, yes. And that'll need a, you know, be beefed up the farther you go along. And so the next series that you would normally refer to is would be called an early stage or a Series A. And that's where, you know, it's still a small company where they might not be able to get a bank loan because they're, you know, too speculative or lack assets. And this is where you start to bring in institutional money, meaning, you know, institutional venture capitals or other groups to fund. The next stage would be late stage or growth equity, where your company is more mature and but still might not have earnings history to really raise capital and go out in the public markets, but can continue to raise capital either from people that invested early on or bring in new investors.
So at late stage or growth stage, we've demonstrated we have a business, we've demonstrated our product, we have customers. We just don't have enough customers to fund the next stage of growth, and that's why we're out looking for money.
That's right.
Okay.
And the next phase, or it's not a phase you want to go through, but
it's a realistic phase, though.
Right, it's a distressed investment. And that's where, you know, a company may be over-leveraged or they're facing liquidity issues.
So over-leveraged meaning they're too much debt?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And, you know, their expenses are starting to exceed their revenue and they're running out of money. And so a lot of times this can be provided by existing investors, but it's oftentimes, you know, these terms are going to get worse for the company.
Right. So it's going to be money that's at higher risk, because they're usually going to want a bigger return on that. But this is the money we're going to use to reorganize, step back, restructure, regroup, and then maybe downsize some things to focus the business to grow again.
That's right.
To turn it around.
That's the plan. Another kind of round that you'll often see is just a recapitalization. And this often happens for a family-owned company where they might want liquidity to pay out a retiring founder, or there's kind of some other reason to kind of restructure. You know, this can happen if there's multiple series of preferred stock and you're just trying to kind of simplify it, either to grow the company or to get more fundraising. So that's just kind of a...
Well, I see it with clients that they recapitalize and they raise funds when they've had a shift in the focus. So like a medical device company that, you know, post Obamacare and some of the other regulations that came out, they needed to retrench and regroup. And so they needed to downsize how many owners they had and those kind of pressures. So they wanted the venture capitalist out. So they raised capital from other people that would stay engaged and consistent to buy out the venture capital and bring it. That's the type of thing we're talking about in recapitalizing.
Mm-hmm. And then the next, you know, term I would use is then strategic investment. And that's kind of almost the opposite of what you're talking about, where this is an operating company may want to establish a relationship with kind of a strategic player.
Right. So like a supplier, a customer, even a competitor type thing where it comes in and you want to have access to, say, different distribution channels or different customers, and you make a strategic choice to take on a certain type of investment.
That's right. And competitors is kind of an interesting one too, because that's where, if it's a large competitor, you know, you want to kind of listen, because that might be the person that's going to, you know, be interested in
merger and acquisition.
That's right. So Facebook, you know, you're running a social network, and Facebook wants to invest 5%. You know, you want to listen to that that pitch. But yeah, just kind of in that same industry. And again, it can provide those kind of relationships of taking that business to the next level. But more often than not, it can be kind of a test phase for them seeing how you grow and, you know, wanting to
right.
invest more.
And it's one of those that we have to be careful with. Because once a strategic investor comes in, whether that's upstream and they're vertical, you know, it's somebody supplying you, or it's downstream and they're a customer, then those types of things have implications for who you can do business with for other reasons.
Right.
And so we have to do each of these investment rounds with a strategic focus, a strategic thought as to, if I take this type of money, what does it mean down the road for running the business, taking additional funds somewhere else, exiting the business, and all those kind of things. So we have to keep that in mind, right, when we're doing this.
Definitely. The long-term focus is important for each phase, as far as who you're getting money from, what the terms are, and, you know, why you're getting the money. So yeah, the long-term focus, if you always have that in mind, you know, it's hard as a business owner when you're trying to just pay rent the next month, but you really, if you look towards the future, you want to make sure, okay, will this prevent
right.
something that I really dreamed about from the beginning of the company?
Well, as businesses, especially if we're going through a major growth stage and we're cash poor, or say we're distressed like we were talking about around there, or we need to recapitalize because of some shift internally, we have to be aware that, yes, we have to get through the short term to get to the long term, but we don't want to make a short term decision that impairs our options for the long term.
That's right.
Yeah. So we know the type of rounds, we know what we're going to use it for, we know who we want to talk to. What's that actual private equity process that we go through for? When do we start? What do we need to think about when it comes to timing and all of these types of things?
Yeah, that's a good topic. And, you know, one of the first things I would advise, and being an attorney, this is, you know, self-interested, but to really call your counsel, and that's legal counsel, that's accounting counsel, that's, you know, advisors that can help with the valuation. And so you really want to engage with your partners that, you know, are interested in your business obtaining that money. Because all those things that we're talking about of getting your ducks in a row are going to take some time, and so you're going to need your accountant. The lawyers can assist with that, and, you know, business advisors.
Well, and it takes so much time to raise money. I mean, people need to start. Like, if you need $1 million next year, you're starting now. What is your plan? What is your timing? Because you've got to put together that business plan. You've got to put together those financial statements. You need to do your housekeeping, clean up things, prepare for due diligence. And then you need to start talking, getting introductions to people that can be potential investors, and recognize that it takes a lot of your time as the business owner or whoever's out there raising funds to engage in this process.
That's right. And even once you have everything, you know, we have an investor, we know the amount, it can still take, you know, weeks, if not months, to go from an agreement in principle to a closed deal where the money is in. As you, you know, referred to, you kind of have to do that initial diligence where you're calculating your valuation, and then, you know, the next step is usually negotiate a term sheet with the investor.
And tell it, what's a term sheet? Just tell us what's on that term sheet. What does it include? What doesn't include? What can we expect?
Yeah, a term sheet can. You know, there's a lot of varieties, but it's usually a simple document, can be, you know, one page, usually, you know, 3 to 5 maybe, where it outlines the things we've been talking about, of who's buying the money, how much money is being sold, what are the terms of that, you know, security, whether it's debt, what's the interest rate, if it's stock, what's the dividend rate, and just those other protections that we talked about. So, you know, what's nice about a term sheet is it can be negotiated between business people without having, you know, the lawyers come in, and then we'll draft a much longer document that goes into the details, and then other matters as well.
But like you were saying, the earlier you get your strategic consultants like myself involved, your accounting firm, your lawyers in this process, you have more information when you go to do that term sheet, so you're from a stronger position. And if you've looked at your options and the consequences of those, you come from a better position to negotiate that term sheet. And so if you can originate it in those terms, then have that person potentially investing in. I see a lot of times the clients haven't done a term sheet. They've been reluctant to call their attorney because they know how much money it costs and those kind of things, and they don't look at it as an investment. But in, you know, they get that term sheet negotiated and agreed upon, and then they get to the contract part, and there's something that's precluded that they can't do because of a prior agreement with an investor or some debt instrument or some strategic relationship that they've had that's restricted that, and then they start all over.
Right, and a lot of times the investor is going to drive the process and have the leverage. But by engaging your consultants, you'll be able to get their view on whether that's, you know, what we call market practice, meaning,
right,
you know, they might ask for it, but doesn't mean either they get in every deal or, you know, other similar situated investors might not get those terms. And so that's why, yeah, to engage people that can review, that's going to be important, because once that's signed, it's going to be harder to go back and renegotiate that and say, oh, no, we don't want that interest rate.
Right. I mean, it's costly mistakes. And I think a lot of people wait too long to start the fundraising process, thinking, well, you know, it should only take a few weeks or a few months. And then when we get in there, the things that you need to think about, and there's always something new that comes up. And when you're working with advisors that have gone through this with other clients and other companies, they can warn you of those pitfalls.
That's right.
And those options.
And it's also important that, you know, if this is kind of a later round, let's say, that you have somebody reviewing, you know, the question of, can we do this? Meaning, did our Series A prohibit this? Does, you know, do we have a customer contract that says we won't, you know, sell to a competitor? Or, you know, there's a variety of things that can kind of come into play. It's more than just, we want this money, and yeah, we'll give them a piece of stock certificate.
Right. Well, and that's an excellent point, because when we're trying to raise money, it's, what do we expect for our business? What are the implications? What kind of people are we willing to take money from? What will those strings cause? How will that impact how we operate? How will that impact what customers we can do business with? Who our vendors or our suppliers can be? That whole dynamic of your organization changes as different types of money and their relationships come in. So it starts changing even your business model or your business plan a lot of times based on that funding coming in and the influence of those funders coming in.
That's right. And, you know, so then once you have, assuming you've brought in your counselor, you've negotiated a term sheet, and the next step is then going to be to draft and negotiate the investment documents. And these are going to be longer documents that include the principal terms of the term sheet, but are also going to kind of go into more detail on what they meant when they said 5%, you know, interest. Is that paid quarterly? Is that paid, you know, when does it
annually
pay?
Is it monthly? Is it compounded? Is it all of those types of things?
That's right. And then, you know, what happens if things don't go well? It's usually what lawyers are brought in to do, is think about the different scenarios that might occur, even though if people don't believe they're going to happen.
Right. And we have agreements with people we want to do business with or be engaged in, but we always have to think about, what if this relationship goes wrong? And have that exit strategy or that way to deal with it. So if we're raising funds across state line, and let's say it's a New York firm, New York regulations might come into play for securities that aren't there for North Carolina. Same thing with California money and those kind of things. An LLC in California, can they invest in a C corporation? So what we're looking at, what securities laws allow, what our state laws allow, what our corporate laws, all the types of things come in, what tax implications there are. What, you know, there's all these different issues that agreement's going to cover that we may not think about when we're in that process.
That's right. And then once that's, you know, drafted, then you need to go out and get the approvals that are required to raise that money. So that can be from, you know, your board of directors is going to be required, previous shareholders, and, you know, it can be customer contracts. It's going to be a variety of kind of closing conditions on what do we need. And, you know, what I was referring to earlier, of if you have an uncle that is a shareholder that's hard to get hold of and doesn't have the capability to sign a document, it might take a week or two to go get their signature. So that can be kind of another thing that can delay closing. But once you have all that, you're ready to sign and close, and and receive your money. Now, closings can also kind of occur in stages where an investor says, you know, we'll give X amount now, but then if you reach this milestone, or you know, you have this financial hit this financial target, we'll bring in, you know, additional money. And so closings, first thing I learned as a lawyer, where closings are anticlimactic, where they, you know, they don't happen in a big room with everybody signing documents by hand and, you know, popping champagne.
Well, and that's a thing we need to think about too. If you need to raise, let's say it's $1 million, and the only way to take that money, if you set it up, is like the full million has to be raised. Or you can do it in tranches, segments, and saying, well, after the first $200,000, we can take that and do X with it and raise it in stages, even though the entire million is intended to be raised. Where if you're not thinking about that and it's a tight market, raising that million, you may not make it to that point. You might raise $800,000, and that last $200,000 takes you another 6 months, and now you're out of business because right. You didn't have that funding.
And there could be pros and cons of kind of getting it locked in, or at least, you know, having the ability for the investor to give that option. The pro from the business side is, you know, you've already negotiated it. You don't have to go call your lawyers and accountants again. That, you know, if that milestone's hit, it's a pretty quick closing. But it also locks in the valuation. And so if your business is growing and somebody has the option to come in and say, well, we're going to buy, you know, we're going to put in another million, but it's your company has grown in value. Well, here they've purchased a large stake.
Right. So if they're going to put in another million and your valuation was 5 million and now you've grown and your valuation would be 10 million, you're not getting as much funding for what you're giving up that you could have with increased valuation, is what you're saying.
Right. And we haven't really talked about that, but valuation is a key part in the investment, because that determines the percentage, if we're just talking about, you know, stock, of how much they'll own of the company. And so, you know, every business owner wants to have as high of a valuation as they can convince the investor, because then the investor will get a smaller percentage for what they put in. And so, but that valuation is ever changing as your business ebbs and flows. And
right.
So, you know, early on, everyone that starts a business, I've never talked to somebody that thought their business was less than $1 million. I always kind of start with, of course, it's $1 million idea.
No, it's actually $1 billion idea, and we're just at the $1 million valuation at this point. But yeah.
Right, just to get people in the door. But
right.
So.
Well, and it's, when we talk about the stage of investors, the type of investors coming in, we also have stuff that frequently, and one investor will say, well, I'll invest if you get this investor in at $500,000, I'll follow on with $1 million. But those type of terms and conditions, they don't want to be the first one in the door. They don't want to be the only one in the door. And those kind of dynamics then impact that timing, the terms and conditions, all of those kind of things, right?
That's right. And that's also a good point. That's a great way, though, to bring in multiple investors and kind of divvy up the ownership percentages. So one venture capitalist might own 10% and another one owns 10%. So they have to work together if they're going to try to exercise, you know, their
right.
limited minority ownership. And what's nice about that is, yeah, I can add, you know, once you get one investor kind of in the door, they can start talking to their friends. And so it can increase the amount you're able to raise. And from the investor side, it's kind of nice because they can piggyback on the work of somebody else. So if somebody's already gone in and done their diligence and said, yeah,
right.
we're committing $1 million, they'll say, oh, we trust your judgment. We'll put in $1 million too. And they save on cost because one investor can kind of take the lead on legal review
right.
and other, you know, procedures. And then the other
right. So you're not dealing with two different due diligence processes. You're dealing with one, and the other one's going to take that due diligence process because it's so close in timing and the nature of the relationships and things. And so you're not having to go through re-auditing financial statements or somebody coming in and digging through all your contracts again and those kind of things that come into play.
That's right. They'll probably still want to take a sniff of it and just make sure.
yeah.
They'll want to be involved to some extent, but yes, it'll reduce.
But the
that
valuation,
burden.
You know, you're not normally having to pay for another valuation
right.
or use their valuation as long as you've used a third-party valuation, those kind of things. And it's important, I think, for companies to understand that you're generating your financial statements is not something that people are going to rely on as much as having a CPA firm or someone come in and generate those audited financial statements that can be relied on. It's different. Your friends and family may take your QuickBooks financial statements and not worry about if it's GAAP or not. But as you get more sophisticated investors, there's more expectations. There's also more cost on an ongoing basis of generating those kind of reports as needed for banks, for investment groups and those kind of things to make sure they're reporting. So I like to tell my clients, when you're raising funds, also consider in that the cost of changing the business model from your business processes, contractual things, things that you would do with a handshake now start being required to actually have contracts and things. So there'll be ongoing legal costs to being someone that has an outsider as an investor, a more sophisticated investor.
That's right. And a lot of times the terms of their investment will kind of require that. When you were talking earlier of having an accountant come in and go back into your books for 3 years, it's then a obligation going forward a lot of times that you then provide that audited financial statement to the investors each year, even if you're not raising right. additional money, because they want to track their investment. And when we're talking about private stock, they can't go check NASDAQ or NYSE to see how their stock is doing. They just see financial statements each year.
Well, and you've dealt with public companies, and I have several clients that are public companies that have gone with the IPOs. When you're a small company, and less than, say, 50 employees, and then you go public, and you have to deal with the Sarbanes-Oxley compliance and all of those rules and regulations coming in, you have to think about that investment and the change of the nature and the culture in the business. That now, if you're doing public, you're trading on NASDAQ, you're doing SEC filings, you're on the New York Stock Exchange, whatever that is, those rules and those not just annual requirements, but quarterly requirements to file reports and what kind of people are doing your accounting and are there on a daily basis. And let's add in your government contractor, and now you have those kind of things. Those are things that we have to think about as ongoing costs, but they're ongoing investment. They're expenditures, but they're really an investment when we're talking about understanding what those requirements are going to be and how that's going to shift your ongoing legal needs, your accounting needs, and all those kind of things.
Yeah, and that's what's difficult about that too is when you're talking to clients of, an audit is going to cost, if it's kind of the same documents, right. It's going to cost the same amount no matter what the numbers are
right.
or how big your business
there's a,
is.
There's a minimum entry point for doing an audit. I don't think we've ever, even for the smallest clients, had a bill of less than a $5,000 for just the most basic, look at it, are you complying with some things? Add in generating GAAP compliant financial statements with all footnotes and all those kind of things. It starts jumping up.
Right.
And the more people you have to report it to, how frequently, all of those kind of things become a factor in that.
Yeah. And the same thing for the legal expenses is, our billing practices don't change if it's a $10 million deal versus a $50,000 deal. If it requires the same amount of documentation and diligence,
right.
all that kind of goes into that. And so that's just a difficult kind of reality of, it's the dollar amount is going to.
Yeah, what's the ratio of your legal costs or your other consulting costs and your accounting, the audit, in proportion to how much money you're going to raise? But if those costs, are going to be $50,000 across everything you're doing, then that $50,000 needs to be included in the amount of money you're raising. Because you need to recover that to put it back in because you've just spent it out of your normal cash flow.
Right. And then look into the future of what the dividend rate is, what the interest rate is, and what that money is going to cost going forward.
Right. So, it's an interesting dynamic. And the environment we're in, I hear mixed things. Some areas, there's a lot of interest still in, let's call it the Facebook companies, the apps, the programs, the things that are out there in the virtual world. And then we have manufacturing companies that are here trying to do things, and we have, life science, medical. We have all these dynamics going on. So as we're ending the show, if you could think of 3 to 4 things that we could tell the listener to do today, if they're going to plan to raise funds, what are those steps? What are those things that just jump out and say, okay, regardless of the size of your business, regardless of what you're going to do, you need to do these things?
Yes, and I'll try to keep track of my numbers, but the first thing you're going to want to do is kind of evaluate where you are and kind of the decisions you made up to this point and really get everything organized, because the second step I'm going to say is reach out to your accountants, your lawyers, and your other strategic advisors. But you want to have everything kind of organized to make that an efficient process and to save you money, so the accountant isn't having to go through your file drawers to find your receipts. So once you're organized, then the second thing would be to reach out and to get advice and think about specifically for your company what the next steps might be, and then, you know, kind of follow the advice of those advisors would be a simple third step, because that's going to vary depending on who you're trying to raise money from, the structure, different things we've talked about, and you really want to have trusted advisors that can provide, you know, the legal or accounting expertise, but also the business advice on, you know, the things you're talking about. If it might be too expensive to do this, you know, this is something else you may want to consider, just to kind of make sure you don't go down a path where you're locking in some investor, and then you bring in your advisor that tells you, you know,
this is a bad idea. Right. Well, Jeff, I want to thank you for being on the show today. And we've learned a lot. And I hope you'll come back so we can talk more about some of the details of convertible notes and all those kind of things. And next week, we are going to have the grant show that I said was coming on this week. I'm crazy with the schedule right now. Everything keeps moving around. And we'll have our guest, Eva Garland, to talk about grant funding as an alternative. And until next week, we hope you will stay focused on the important things in life.